The letter went unanswered, and Beach assumed that Al Conyers was frightened by it. Ricky was on his way to Baltimore, just an hour from Washington, and that was too close for Al. While waiting for an answer from Al, the Quince Garb money landed, followed by the wire from Curtis in Dallas, and the brethren found renewed energy in their scam. Ricky wrote Al the letter that was intercepted and analyzed at Langley. Now suddenly, Al's third letter had a very different tone. Ben Yarber read it twice, then reread the second letter from Al. "Sounds like a different person, doesn't it?" he said.
"Yes, it does," Beach said, looking at both letters. "I think the old boy is finally excited about meeting Ricky.
I thought he worked for the government."
"Says he does."
"Then what's this about having business interests in Baltimore?"
"We worked for the government, didn't we?"
"Sure."
"What was your highest salary on the bench?"
"When I was Chief Justice, I made $150,000.
"I made $140,000.
"Some of those professional bureaucrats make more than that. Plus, he's not married."
"That's a problem."
"Yeah, but let's keep pushing. He's got a big job, which means he's got a big boss, lots of colleagues, typical Washington hotshot. We'll find a pressure point somewhere."
"Oh, what the hell?" Finn said.
What the hell indeed? What was there to lose? So what if they pushed a little too hard and Mr. Al got scared or got mad and decided to throw the letters away? You can't lose what you don't have.
Serious money was being made here. It was not a time to be timid. Their aggressive tactics were producing spectacular results. The mail was growing each week, as was their offshore account. Their scam was foolproof because their pen pals lived double lives. Their victims had no one to complain to. Negotiations were quick because the market was ripe. It was still winter in Jacksonville, and because the nights were chilly and the ocean was too cool to swim in, the busy season was a month away. There were hundreds of small rentals available along Neptune Beach and Atlantic Beach, including one almost directly across the street from Trevor. A man from Boston offered $600 cash for 2 months, and the real estate agent snatched it. The place was furnished with odds and ends no flea market would handle. The old shag carpet was well worn and emitted a permanent musty smell. It was perfect. The renter's first chore was to cover the windows. Three of them faced the street and looked across to Trevor's, and during the first few hours of surveillance, it became obvious how few clients came and went. There was so little business over there. When work surfaced, it was usually done by the secretary, Jan, who also read a lot of magazines. Others quietly moved into the rental, men and women with old suitcases and large duffel bags filled with electronic wizardry. The fragile furnishings were shoved to the rear of the cottage, and the front rooms were quickly filled with screens and monitors and listening devices of a dozen varieties. Trevor himself would make an interesting case study for third-year law students. He arrived around 9 a.m. and spent the first hour reading newspapers. His morning client seemed to always arrive at 10:30, and after an exhaustive half-hour conference, he was ready for lunch, always at Pete's Bar and Grill. He carried a phone with him to prove his importance to the bartenders there, and he usually made two or three unnecessary calls to other lawyers. He called his bookie a lot. Then he walked back to his office, past the rental where the CIA monitored every step, back to his desk where it was time for a nap. He came to life around 3 and hit it hard for 2 hours. By then, he needed another long neck from Pete's. The second time they followed him to Trumbull, he left the prison after an hour and returned to his office about 6 p.m. While he was having dinner in an oyster bar on Atlantic Boulevard, alone, an agent entered his office and found his old briefcase. In it were 5 letters from Percy and Ricky. The commander of the Silent Army in and around Neptune Beach was a man named Klockner, the best Teddy had in the field of domestic street spying. Klockner had been instructed to intercept all mail flowing through the law office. When Trevor went straight home after leaving the oyster bar, the 5 letters were taken across the street to the rental, where they were opened, copied, then resealed and replaced in Trevor's briefcase. None of the five was for Al Conyers. At Langley, DeVille read the five letters as they came off the fax. They were examined by two handwriting experts who agreed that Percy and Ricky were not the same people. Using samples taken from their court files, it was determined without much effort that Percy was really former Justice Finn Yarber and that Ricky was former U.S. District Judge Hatley Beach. Ricky's address was the Aladdin North Box at the Neptune Beach Post Office. Percy, to their surprise, used a postal box in Atlantic Beach, one rented to an outfit called Laurel Ridge.